Hello, and welcome to Season 8 of the Canadian Women's Foundation podcast, All Right, Now What? Gender equality and justice, where we live, work, learn, and play, is the goal, and it makes life better for everyone. All Right, Now What? Remains a space where we ask, how do we move from awareness to action? But this season, we're also shifting the story. Through powerful storytelling, expert interviews, and bold conversations, we'll explore what true equity can look like, especially for those who are too often silenced or overlooked. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and its partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Inuit, and Métis territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.
Hi, I'm Rachel Leslie from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Today, we're joined by disability inclusion advocate, storyteller, and 2026 Feminist Creator Prize recipient, Jenna Barnable. In our conversation, Jenna reflects on growing up in a small rural community without disabled role models, and how those experiences shaped her commitment to becoming the kind of mentor and advocate she wishes she had growing up. We talk about ableism, some of the harmful myths and stereotypes that continue to shape how disability is understood, and why disability justice has to be a part of our conversations about gender justice, equity, and inclusion. Jenna also shares how storytelling, authenticity, and showing up as her full self through projects like Finding Avalon and disability podcasts have created spaces where disabled people feel seen, heard, and safe to exist without masking. Together, we explore the power of disabled-led advocacy, the importance of building truly accessible communities, and why shifting the story around disability requires all of us to listen, learn, and act. Hi, Jenna. It's so nice to have you here today.
Oh, hi, Rachel. It's a total delight to be here with you.
So I wanted to jump right in. We really want to chat through your journey and you know what brought you to what you do now and to your work and your representation. And you've spoken about growing up without disabled role models. And now you're becoming that representation for others. And so how would you describe that journey?
Oh, that journey is always ongoing. I'm still learning and unlearning all the time. And I think that's the point, right? I grew up in a beautiful, small, and very Irish fishing village in Newfoundland. And there wasn't much access to disability, like resources or supports, and certainly not the kind of growing awareness that we finally have now. So like most rural and remote places anywhere in the world, ableism is deep-rooted. And it's built into the social mentality. Disability is still often a taboo topic. And even when it is spoken about, it's still quite influenced by outdated bias, stigma in the form of harmful jokes. And these are all based on incorrect stereotypes. And this disability discrimination is also known as ableism. And even though ableism is usually not intentional at all, it is deep-seated. And it's driven by colonialism, capitalism, patriarchy, religion, and even superstitions or folk beliefs. And again, this is found all around the world in so many cultures, not just where I grew up. And therefore, there's just so much to unlearn. And this is so much harder when the ignorance and harm is being reinforced every day through inaccurate disability representation in the media. And for me, growing up, my neurodivergence and my early symptoms of a neurological illness went unrecognized. Nobody was looking for this in girls. The awareness just wasn't there. It's nobody's fault. There's gender bias in research, and people were just looking for what affected boys and men, right? And for young girls and gender diverse folks, few adults really do listen to us when we're young or take our struggles seriously, especially if we seem to be functioning just fine or doing well in school or masking, in other words. And I became a champion masker and ended up struggling right up through to my adult years now. So fast forward to today, and I'm a mentor for disabled, chronically ill, and neurodivergent girls, gender diverse, and queer youth. We're in different times now, even if change is still a little slower than I'd like it to be. But now we have more information, more awareness, and more opportunity to make proper progress for disability rights, disability education, that's for disabled folks and non-disabled folks alike, you know, allies in the making, and also for disability inclusion. And a common origin story for advocates of all kinds is that we usually become, for others, the person that we needed and didn't have when we were younger. And I feel like that's the case for me because I feel very protective of disabled youth because I know just how vulnerable they can be. You know, they face increased risks of discrimination compared to their non-disabled peers, risks of trauma that's completely avoidable. And to me, it's not acceptable that their life trajectories are being needlessly impacted. You know, so I really think that disabled-led guidance is essential, you know, being a disabled mentor, not just because it's relatable to a disabled young person, but because it's informed from lived experience and pretty deep and sometimes painful knowledge about navigating the systems that, you know, we live through. Having access to safe people and resources can be life-changing, especially in rural and remote places where access or options might be limited or are completely limited. Young disabled people have a lot of questions when they're planning to launch into post-secondary studies or the workplace or even exploring self-employment. That's why I offer mentoring sessions that are online and accessible and cost-free. That's to remove barriers. It's a confidential, judgment-free conversation where I listen and validate and guide them toward resources and try to help them find solutions. I'd really love to see a national support service developed for disabled youth and led by a collective of disabled professionals, because as much as we individual advocates like me want to help bridge this gap and become mentors. And so I think that here in Canada, that's something that we could really do better with and collectively contribute to.
Yeah, absolutely. As you were saying that, I think you said life-changing, but I would even extend that to life-saving. I think for young people, even from elementary or primary school, whatever we call it, on, to feel like they're not alone. And then even for support for their parents to realize, you know, what's possible and how they can support is super important.
Yeah, you're right, though. It is life-saving because we know that discrimination, trauma, all the things that happen to young people when they're already developing, it's already a hard enough time. You're developing, you're coming into your own. And depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide, these are very serious concerns. These are very real risks, especially for disabled youth, especially for neurodivergent youth. Autistic girls, for example, are 7 times more likely to die by suicide, and that only increases as they become adults. So for me, I feel that urgency. That's why I say I'm so protective, because I know myself, the things that I went through growing up, unrecognized, disabled, as a young person. Kids Helpline saved my life a number of times when I called in as a distressed and isolated young person who felt like I was, you know, in the middle of nowhere with no way out. And that's so true. You have a voice on the other end of the line, or a person that you're connecting with who can help you see that there's going to be something else for you, right?
Yeah, I think this ties in really well to the next question. As you mentioned, you're doing a lot of work educating others and on anti-ableism, accessibility, language, protection, as we mentioned. So what are some of the most common misconceptions that you're challenging right now?
Oh, Rachel, there are so many misconceptions about disability, but I can name three very common ableist themes that I think really need to be taken off of the non-disabled conversation loop, like things that we just need to stop going around and around in circles on. And I'll give you just very high level, you know, there's a lot of nuance to this, but I'll give you three myths that, you know, constantly come up in my anti-ableist education and even in just the advocacy work that I do and the conversations online. And the first myth is that most disabilities are obvious and easy to detect. If you can't see it, it likely doesn't affect them that much and it isn't as serious or as valid as other recognizable conditions. This is so commonly uttered. I always wish I could just plug my ears because, you know, as an educator and an activist and an advocate, you can feel like a broken record talking about these same things. Like we need to get past that so that we can actually have action and change, right? So the fact here is that well over 80% of all disabilities are not apparent, you know? And so, you know, most conditions are invisible to you, but very, very real to us, like chronic pain and chronic illness, mental health conditions, neurodivergence, hearing loss, and, you know, really the majority of all disabilities. Most people do automatically think of a wheelchair or a white cane or things that are very obvious and clearly understood or usually symbolized on signage, right? So a lot of people only see what's above the surface and nothing about the truth and the real life that's happening underneath. You know, so when you say that I look too good to be sick or look too good to be disabled, that is so invalidating. It's very harmful. It's very silencing and othering. So we really have to move beyond this kind of surface level reductive judgment that keeps that grip of ableism so strong, right? And please, please, please don't compare disabled people. Even if you know somebody who has a similar condition or the same condition, none of us are alike. We're not a monolith. All of our outcomes are very different. We can have the same condition and so many different realities. Plus, our lives are different, not just our bodies and our minds and our systems, right? And like, not to judge and rank disabled people's valid conditions, because disability exists on a spectrum, by the way, you know, and they can range from temporary disabilities and injuries to episodic conditions, right? To chronic conditions. Chronic means it will keep going. It's constant. It's never going to go away, right? This is what chronic is. And that takes a lot of resilience to deal with when you don't know from one day to the next or hour to the next. And then finally, people have a really hard time understanding what dynamic disability is. Dynamic means constantly changing. It's shifting and changing all the time. I can't tell you what I will be like this afternoon. It's maddening. It's confusing for you. Can you imagine how frustrating and confusing it is for me to not know what my body is going to do? How I'm going to feel, how can I plan for a future and plan for life? The second myth is that, and this one is one that I'm sure anyone listening will recognize. They'll either have heard it from somebody else or they might have even thought it, because ableism is within all of us, right? Ableism is deep rooted. That disabled people are faking it for attention, that they can't really be in that condition, especially if it's a non-visible disability. And the other part of this myth is that most disabled people are just looking for special treatment or something extra or benefits. They don't want to work. And that us receiving accommodations is unfair to non-disabled people. Right? So there's a lot. The fake claiming, you know, and, you know, looking for special treatment, not wanting to work or study and wanting to have something done special for us, and we shouldn't get it if everyone isn't getting it. This is a huge, huge, huge pillar of ableism. So I'll hit you with the fact, and there are multiple points to this fact, but when it comes to faking, we actually fake being well. We don't fake being sick or disabled. We are constantly masking and downplaying very concerning pain and symptoms for other people's discomfort, for your comfort, to avoid mistreatment and discrimination. Because when we even show a glimpse, we see what happens. We are definitely not looking for attention, especially not when we actually already receive so much harmful and negative attention as it is. We don't want to be attracting more. We already have to deal with navigating through a life full of barriers, dealing with our health, dealing with ableism, yes, dealing with the attention that comes with that, even when you're not seeking it. And then if you do raise an issue, then you're a troublemaker or a problem causer or a complainer. So many disabled, chronically ill, and neurodivergent professionals truly want to work. So like saying that we don't want to work, it is so untrue. I talk with hundreds and hundreds of disabled people all year, every year. The grief that is connected with not being able to work is massive on top of everything else we deal with, right? And that reality also includes physically unsafe workplaces, psychologically unsafe workplaces, failure to provide even the most basic accommodations, barriers to opportunities once you do have the job, opportunities to advance, being left out, being underpaid because you're disabled, and also being ostracized sometimes because people in the workplace aren't comfortable with disabled coworkers. Yes, even in 2026 here in Canada, this is a reality. Disabled people, we are skilled and we are dedicated and we are innovative and we want to work. And not being able to work because of our health or because of the ableist barriers that just automatically assume and make a decision for us to block us out, all of this completely breaks our hearts. It breaks our hearts. And when it comes to the part of the myth about disability benefits, oh, you just want to get something for nothing. You don't want to work. You just want benefits. You want something that we can't get. The reality is very grim. You know, the reality is that these benefits that we're talking about are very inadequate. They are not easily accessed. They can take years in circular attempts to try to qualify. The reality is that many disabled people live far below the poverty line as it is, and benefits don't even touch their needs, right? You know, and finally, the last part about this myth is that disabled accommodations and accessibility is not special treatment at school or at work. Disabled rights are human rights. I'm going to say it again. Disabled rights are human rights. Us receiving accommodations is not taking away from other people. We want you to get the supports you need too. If by chance you become sick or injured or disabled in any way, you also deserve that support. You know, you deserve accommodations. And if hearing me say this, you know, that this is not special treatment, if hearing me say this makes you feel uncomfortable or makes you feel like, you know, indignant about it, that is a very clear sign that you have a lot of work to do on your inner ableism. And I don't even just say this to non-disabled people. Disabled people also have a lot of internalized ableism because we're washed with the same messages from media and from, you know, social culture and from everyone we know, everything we hear. We are brainwashed with that as well, that disability is a tragic, terrible thing, something to be shameful of, something that needs to be fixed, something that is only tolerable if we're exceptional, something that's only okay if we're still productive under capitalism, not that we have inherent human value as it is, which we do, right? And so I do ask people to really consider working on whatever ableism is affecting you, whether it's straight up ableism, whether it is internalized ableism for disabled folks. So anyone listening, if any of this strikes accord in a good way or a bad way, I would love for you to take some time and seek out some more resources about dismantling ableism, because it's something that society and media continues to wash over us. And that brings me to the very last of these top three myths that we keep hearing. And that is when people say, it is not my place to speak up or get involved if I'm not disabled. Accessibility and disabled matters are none of my business. Like, that's their concern. That's their fight. I feel bad for them, or I don't care about it, or whatever the mentality is. It doesn't impact me. And why should I get involved or care? You know, and I would say, as somebody who really believes in people, that we can all do better, you know, and I understand sometimes there's a knee-jerk reaction, you know, when you're coping with enough in your life and there's a lot going on. Look, just look at the media, look at the world that we are in right now. It is easy to silo and close down and shudder and just say, nope, I'm locking the door to everything else. I've got enough and I'm at capacity. And that's valid. But that is not something for community growth or personal growth, because one day, eventually, disability will touch your life, right? And so the fact is that every single person alive today can and will develop disability at some point in their lives, whether that's through illness or injury or, the most common cause, naturally aging into disability. We're human. That's what we do. If we're lucky enough to live a long life, we are going to age into disability. So disability inclusion and rights and accessibility affects us all. And that makes it everyone's business. So by that token, anti-ableism is for everybody. Anti-ableism and speaking up when we see barriers to dignified human treatment or safe, accessible spaces, these are things that we all have a duty and a right to act upon. It doesn't need to affect you directly to become something you care about. We disabled folks want and we need allies. And when I talk about allies, it's not just somebody who, of course, you know, feels for whatever cause it is, and in this case, it would be anti-ableism and inclusion and accessibility. We actually need people who will act with us. They're guided by us, right? You're not speaking for us. The principle of the disability community is nothing about us without us. And that's what a good, solid ally does. It's not about them. They're not the star. They're the supporting character who has so much value as our supporter and our ally. And you can speak up in an appropriate way that you've learned through anti-ableism education and through your conversations with disabled people. When I say that we want and we need allies, I say that because we cannot do this alone. We can't. It takes an entire community of loved ones and neighbors and colleagues and everyone to actually make real change. So to all of our allies and our allies in training, and even people who just, you know, they're curious, they want to learn more, or people who are really into the social justice space and want to broaden their support, I really would ask to look at anti-ableism training for yourself and self-guided. And then, you know, be guided by us as well when you have questions, but also don't expect us to do the emotional labor of constantly being your teachable moment, because that is something that disabled people also have to carry, right? And I can point you to plenty of resources. And, you know, reach out to me if you're hearing this and you're thinking, well, I want to start my journey to become an anti-ableist ally. I don't know where to begin, but reach out to me and I will definitely point you in the right direction.
Thank you, Jenna. I feel and see your passion and appreciate that so much. And yeah, what I wrote down was allyship. But also, as you said, we will all, it's a human right, and we will all deal with disability for ourselves or with our families in our lifetimes. And I guess, yeah, the other thing I wrote down was don't negate someone's experience when they aren't masking, when they are open and feel like they can share with you, that you don't come back with, no, that's not right.
It's a very human knee-jerk reaction to want to negate or debate. And that's all about ego and power and thing, and also, you know, insecurity. If people could just pause, give themselves a 30-second pause instead of listening to respond, listen to digest, listen to understand. But if you just take a second and really hear that person and listen to them and validate them, two things can be true at once. This person's experience is valid.
I will switch now, as you mentioned your podcast, and I'll quote you to you, Jenna, if that's okay. you said, there's power in the stories we share. When we tell our stories in solidarity, we are empowered to create meaningful change for safe, inclusive communities. So your podcast, Finding Avalon, and you have a new video series, Disability, which we love, have resonated deeply with audiences. So what do you think people are responding to or are empowered by in your storytelling?
I think that people respond to authenticity, you know, in many forms, especially these days. You know, people are craving real. They're seeking substance and connection and community in a time that feels so disconnected and chaotic and frightening. And we're living in a media landscape that's increasingly manufactured. We are consistently being manipulated with disinformation in the media. There's mind-numbing generative AI and a rise in online hate. So people are seeking safety, substance, and authenticity. That's what I really believe. You know, I'm a person, I'm not a product. My only agenda is to be myself, be of service to others, and continue to develop myself as a human being while also fighting for what matters to me. I'm all about the perfectly imperfect. I'm more concerned with substance over style, you know, authenticity over aesthetics, and humanity over popularity. I don't try to fit in or follow non-disabled, neurotypical norms or formulas. As a creator, that would be defeating the purpose, and it would only lead me to more masking and more performance and more messaging that disabled people should hide who and how they are. So no thank you to that. I try to show up as I am. I'm just one representation of a disabled, chronically ill, and neurodivergent feminist creator. I'm one of many. I pay attention to my followers' feedback, and my followers are both disabled and non-disabled. They're self-advocates and they're allies or allies in training. You know, it's such a disservice to non-disabled and disabled people to play us so wrong, to expect nothing, to expect, you know, only the tragedy or the inspiration story. We are full-fledged people. We have feisty attitudes. We are all kinds of shapes and sizes. And so it's nice that when I share on my podcast and when they see all the different guests that are on the podcast, they're going, wait, I never thought about disability like this. And so that's super important to me. That's the whole reason I wanted to do this. You know, I want to normalize showing up as a disabled person, as my disabled self, my human self, perfectly imperfect.
Yeah, I think when you're mentioning, like, you show up as your whole self, but then you also create that space where other people feel it's healing or safe to do that as well. And to really, you know, as you said, authenticity just shines through.
Sometimes we need someone else to remind us to do that and to give us permission to do that. right? Because we are taught to present a certain way. This is how society raises us, right? And I just always encourage and compliment people when they're really being themselves. Like, they're being themselves, and it's not always safe to show up as your full self. It's true when people say, come to work and bring your whole self. You know, that sounds good in writing, but the reality is if it's not a psychologically safe space, and if it's not a space with people who are ready for that or even can understand that, you know, that's not really possible. But with my podcast and my video series and the advocacy work and the workshops and things I do, I really try to make that a safe space where people understand that, you know, I can laugh at myself. I can make mistakes. I can show up looking or feeling however, and that's still valuable and valid. And so are you, you know?
So as you just mentioned, you have built a powerful platform and impact with minimal to no funding, I say support, but you have lots of support from your followers. But funding, I guess, would be the main thing there. What do you think that says about the barriers that disabled creators face, and what do you think needs to change?
That's a great question, Rachel. Like, when I say this project was created from blood, sweat, and tears, I really mean it. There was a massive amount of work and learning, everything from the financial cost to building everything from scratch, wearing all the hats, like I said, all while navigating life being disabled and unwell. You know, I wish it had been easier, that I didn't have to sacrifice my own limited financial and even my energetic resources to create and launch it. But I'm also really proud of what I did, just from grit and determination alone. But that's the reality for disabled creators who are almost always under-resourced and unsupported. You know, for sure, this approach is not sustainable for any creator, but especially for disabled, chronically ill, and neurodivergent creators. Before I decided to go the grassroots indie route, I had tried for years unsuccessfully to get grants or assistance to make Finding Avalon and its projects a reality. Years. Unfortunately, provincial and national funding bodies are pretty inaccessible and not at all easy to navigate if you're disabled. Even when these programs or opportunities are advertised loudly as inclusive and accommodating, I quickly and repeatedly discovered that it was lip service that led to nowhere, unfortunately. And this is not just an inclusion integrity issue, it's ableism in these systems. Services, support, and specific accommodations were offered and promised only to never be acted upon. It's absolutely gutting and demoralizing, not to mention exhausting for a disabled creator. You know, for me, I'm chronically ill. I'm also disabled. I'm also autistic, right? But I also have grant writing experience. I have years of experience in the arts and cultural world. And so for me to have to go through this fruitless path full of barriers and full of promises, but no real action to back up those words in the processes, that just gave me the message that I didn't matter, right? Needless to say, disabled people shouldn't be experiencing wall after wall like this, you know, or the financial hardship to say, okay, well, if no one's going to back me and no one believes in me and no one is listening, then I'll do it myself with what limited resources I have, or I'll go without this year to make this happen. You know, we shouldn't have to sacrifice and suffer to be able to equally participate and contribute to Canada's cultural and educational and societal services. This is where you have that stubborn self-belief that a lot of maverick creators and marginalized creators show up with, right? Even with the lack of funding and support, I still did that. like all on my own. And I am proud of that. I shouldn't have had to suffer to do it, you know, but I'm proud of what I created. That's how strongly compelled I feel as an advocate and a change maker and an activist, like, to be of service. Disabled voices belong in the media. They belong in the community. They belong in your living room. They belong in your workplace, right? They belong on your social media feed. And disabled voices need to be represented accurately and with dignity and in all of our technicolor truth, right? And Rachel, there's so much more that I want to do, so many projects that could also have an impact that's of value to Canadians, the way that this project has shown itself to be. But realistically, this is not negative thinking. This is real lived experience. Realistically, I can't move forward without accessibility and equity in opportunities that are being offered to everyone else. And it does make me wonder how many disabled creators and brilliant artists and life-changing educators will never have a chance to make a contribution or to create change with what they have inside of them to offer, right? And my housing or my food or my medical costs, I'm already going without to bring this to the world, right? The exposure and the practical financial support that came with the Feminist Creator Prize really makes me feel so hopeful. It was so exciting and such an honor to receive, to be validated, but also I'm a pragmatic person. I'm trying to create this. And so now I go, oh, what a relief that I can recoup at least a portion of last year's operational and equipment costs with the prize money. But I'm not really sure what I'm going to do about this current year's costs, right? If I'm lucky, maybe I'll find a generous benefactor or kind donors who want to help me cover current and future basic operating costs so my work can continue. But, you know, it's a dicey game when you're disabled and under-resourced. And it means so much to me as a creator, not only to have the powerful feeling of recognition and being seen as a disabled feminist creator, but also to know that financially I can make it possible. Someone believes in me. Somebody wants to back me and say, keep going. There's no words for that. And I do have to say, I did find the awards program very accessible, very supportive, super easy to navigate. And that was so refreshing after everything I've just described to you, right, that I've gone through. You know, other organizations have so many obstacles. And I think there's only been maybe 3 or 4 examples that I could think of that were anywhere close to how accessible the Feminist Creator Prize process was for the people who nominated me. They told me, well, that was so easy. That was easy for me to do, straightforward. And then as a nominee to be able to submit, I guess, the materials I submitted, and to know that if I needed something in a different format or if I needed support, it really was there. And it was, right? You know, it shouldn't be such a joy to have basic access. But after the realities I've experienced and other disabled creators experience, you know, it felt like winning the lottery just to be allowed on the playing field. You know, and that really speaks volumes, right? Now I'm going to run around that playing field shouting and hooting and hollering and, you know, singing your praises for that. You know, really and truly, I thank you for it, you know. The Canadian Women's Foundation is fostering diverse feminist creator work, right? Instead of allowing it to fizzle out on the fringes. And there's a saying that if a flower doesn't bloom, you fix the environment, not the flower. Well, I'm going to add to that, because disabled creators like writers and artists, performers and educators and podcasters, they deserve designated space in Canada's colorful garden. And we can only do that, though, with equally fertile soil, access to watering and sunlight, careful tending all along the way, and then a genuine appreciation as we bloom.
That's beautiful. And thank you for saying that. that is the intention with the Feminist Creator Prize, to be accessible, but also, I mean, we took notes this year on other ways we could improve or give options for people to submit things, and are always trying to tweak that. But even the prize itself was created really for, you know, as you said, people working off the side of their desks and looking for funding, and how can we show up in that space and not tie it to a report or a you know, you can pay yourself, or you can start a project, or you can rest. And so that was very important in the initial iteration of it. So as you just mentioned, you're one of this year's recipients of the Feminist Creator Prize. What does this recognition mean to you?
Yeah, to me, the Feminist Creator Prize recognizes the diversity of all feminist creators across Canada. And I think that focus on representation is a powerful legacy. Being disabled with a progressive, incurable chronic illness means realistically my time is limited. And I don't say that with fear, I say it as fuel. It fuels a strong sense of urgency to create and make change for other disabled Canadians and for the whole community. And being a leader as a feminist who lives with multiple disabilities also helps challenge and dispel disability discrimination. This award highlights how feminism and anti-ableism are intertwined, how they belong together, and how the systems of oppression that impact both of these movements are rooted in the same place. I also want to say that how proud I am to be selected as a Newfoundlander and Labradorian who's now living in Nova Scotia. You know, I'm representing for the very often underrepresented region that I come from, a place that I'm so proud to call home, you know, Atlantic Canada. And I really want to applaud the Canadian Women's Foundation for leading and championing an awards program like this that showcases such diversity of Canadian feminists. Not only does this award validate my work and my vision as a disabled feminist, but it also broadcasts a clear message that here in Canada, feminism that's both diverse and inclusive is actually a genuine priority. And as a disabled and intersectional feminist, this award feels like belonging. It feels like healing. It also feels like justice. It feels like a hopeful, bright spot in dark times, but most of all, it feels like a promise that we will keep advancing the feminist movement in ways that include and elevate every one of us. And all of this together feels like much needed change. You know, being a recipient feels like it's such an important milestone that it can propel me to continue advocating and creating and educating for disabled gender justice, because there are more cycles and barriers needing to be broken, and I'm nowhere near done.
So yeah, as our podcast is called, All Right, Now What? I'll ask you, all right, now what? In a world where disability justice is still under-recognized, even in feminist movements, and under-resourced, as we've mentioned today, what role do creators like you play in shifting the narrative? And I would add to that, not just you, Jenna, but as you mentioned, the allies and the other Feminist Creator Prize winners and the feminist creators in the space. What role do we all play in shifting that narrative?
Well, first, thanks for acknowledging that. Disability is so often entirely left out of the DEI equation and out of movements, even feminism, though I'm hopeful that I see that change happening. Disabled, chronically ill, and neurodivergent people continue to be that one equity group that is routinely excluded from inclusion, even now in 2026. And much of this is because people are uncomfortable and uninformed about disability, and often they're afraid to learn or to ask questions or possibly get it wrong. But this only allows ableism and its barriers to grow and to undo all of the work that disabled advocates are doing. That's why I'm building a disabled-led and disabled-centric space with my projects. I'm trying to shift the narrative by normalizing talking and learning about disability and unlearning, you know, and also encouraging and insisting that we all unlearn, right? I'm unapologetic about that. I will never, ever apologize for that. That's why I'm here. I'm trying to make this a safe space for everyone, both disabled and non-disabled folks, to learn and to work together for change, especially around disabled gender justice. As a creator and a storyteller, I'm examining current issues from different disabled perspectives and amplifying the voices that have so often gone unheard or unconsidered. Disabled people are complex, and we're complete human beings. We have so much valuable experience to share, and we actually have an impact everywhere we are, right? And not just creators. My hope is that people who engage with my creator work will feel curious and motivated to take further steps to become anti-ableist, and that they'll listen to and believe and learn from disabled people and then become allies, as you mentioned, by acting alongside of us and guided by us and welcomed by us. And for the disabled folks that are tuning into my podcast or interacting on my socials, sharing your stories and your wisdom is all part of that collective movement to become strong self-advocates and really supportive disability community members.
Thank you for helping shift the story on safety, leadership, justice, power, and rights. You can visit CanadianWomen.org today to learn more and stay connected. We believe everyone should be able to exist without fear of harassment or abuse. You can help make that a reality. Text SAFE, S-A-F-E, to 20222 to give $10 and support women, girls, and gender diverse people throughout Canada. Small actions can lead to big changes. We appreciate your support.